wanted to listen to your phone calls. They'd have to get permission from the court. But, and I'm quoting here, without our knowledge or consent, virtually every entry we make on a social network or other website is surreptitiously being tracked and assessed. The information is just as sensitive, the harm is just as real, but the law is not as protective. That's from Andrew's new book, I Know Who You Are and I Saw What You Did. She calls for a new constitution to protect privacy and speech online and offers one at the end of the book that begins, We the People of Facebook Nation. Lori Andrews is a law professor, director of the Institute for Science, Law, and Technology at the Illinois Institute of Technology, and she joins us here in our Philadelphia studios. And Lori Andrews, are you trying to scare us? Thanks for joining us today on Radio Times.
Oh, I'm trying to inform you, but most people are shocked that their online self has become more important than their offline self. They had no idea that 35% of employers look at Facebook pages and will not hire someone if they have a drink in their hand. So perfectly legal behaviors are being used against people. One in five college admissions officers is looking at a Facebook page. And we might think, okay, people should just be more careful about what they post on Facebook. But without people's knowledge or consent, data aggregators are tracking you, your web searches. I also write mystery books, so I often have web searches about, you know, date rape drugs and how to kill people. Well, that could be a trigger for the police to come knocking on my door. So all of this is going on, and courts are not very protective of people.
And I want to pick up on all of that. One of the things that you write, and I guess this is something we should all know, which is that you are what you post.
Yeah, unlike Vegas, what happens at Facebook doesn't stay in Facebook. And so, you know, take this injured woman in an actual lawsuit. She was harmed. She had six operations, had pins in her spine, and she sued the person who injured her. It came in part of her employment. The judge actually said, well, she was smiling in her Facebook photo, so she couldn't actually be hurt. And so the representation of her online became more important than the real her. Or another case, a woman who posted something sexy on her boyfriend's Facebook page lost custody of her child. Now, the judge didn't look at, is she a good mother? Is the kid healthy? And so our digital doppelgangers have more control over how we're treated. They affect what kind of credit we get in a credit card, how we do in court, even whether we get a kidney. And people just don't realize it. You're at home alone on the web. You have no idea someone's looking over your shoulder.
But is it because we're just too trusting, or we literally just don't know what's going on, in a sense, behind our digital backs?
Yeah, we don't know what's going on. I had no idea until I started writing this book. It's my 14th book. I use dictionary.com. I had no idea dictionary.com puts 233 cookies on my computer. And so we're not making an informed choice about what data is collected about us.
Because it's happening literally behind our back, without our knowledge?
Absolutely. And courts have not been protective. So when consumers first found out about this, some tech-savvy computers could figure out there were all these cookies and web beacons and so forth going on their computers, they sued. And there are federal laws that should protect us, a Wiretap Act, a Computer Fraud and Abuse Act. But the courts said, it's okay if one party gives consent. So if the website, like dictionary.com, has consented to getting paid by data aggregators to put a cookie on your computer that traces wherever you go over the web, it's okay. You can't complain. To me, we've got to change that. It should be the consent of the person whose private information is being used, not the consent of the one financially benefiting. One amazing thing in California, NebuAd, a marketing company, made deals with internet service providers to put hardware on the ISPs. Mm. And they copied and used every single thing the consumers put on their computer, every email, every time anybody filled in a credit card or social security number on an online form. And they were sued. That case has been settled just recently.
Did they lose, I hope?
Well, they were willing to pay money, but they said, since the federal laws don't protect consumers, you can't make a state law claim. The judge disagreed. California happens to have a right to privacy in their constitution. But since it's settled, it's not a precedent to protect us anywhere else in the country.
But don't we have privacy settings? I mean, can't we do a technological fix to, in a sense, protect ourselves?
Sure. But what happens is, and it's a good idea to use maximum privacy settings. And astonishingly, you know, Mark Zuckerberg originally was saying, oh, the younger generation, they don't care about privacy. It turns out that the 18 to 29-year-olds are even more concerned about privacy than the rest of us, and 71% of them use the highest privacy settings. But that doesn't stop data aggregators who use cookies. And now, for example, in Maryland and Massachusetts, potential employers have asked you for your password. And so they want
your personal, private
they want to know what social networks you're on and what's your personal private password in order to see what you're doing that you've considered private. And so, you know, cops, employers, and others want to see that private side. Courts routinely in divorce cases will require you know, one spouse to give their other an entire copy of their hard drive.
Mm.
And so every email you've had, everything you've posted on Match.com, and that's coming into custody cases. If someone posts on Match.com, I'm single, when she isn't yet, that can be used to challenge her credibility over custody of her kids.
But we think of the internet as this anonymous place, a place that you can be anonymous. You can, you know, you can use your dog's picture. You can use an alias and then navigate the net. But you're saying even that is not a protection?
I'm saying that's not a protection because data aggregators use, you know, copies of your emails and web searches, use cookies on your computer to see where you've been, and they link that all together by the address of your computer.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's why you see ads that are targeted to you. But so one thing that happens is that I'm seeing a form of weblining, sort of like the old redlining that where banks would put red lines on a map around districts they didn't want to invest in, usually racially motivated. But now we're having our rights abridged through weblining. And that means that, you know, if you come from a poor zip code of a city, you're not going to be shown credit cards if you go to the Capital One site that are the same as someone from a different district in the city. You might be shown trade ads as opposed to college ads. And so you're being channeled into things based on what is thought to be
your profile.
And it's astonishing. So even whether the complaint department, if someone responds to you online, so if you call up and say, oh, I didn't mean to bounce that check, the person on the other end actually knows through data aggregation whether the person on hold is a man or a woman. And if women are the sort of people who are more docile and would wait longer on the phone, you may have a 40-minute wait as opposed to a man who gets a 10-minute wait. Now, I would notice in a physical bank if they were taking all men in front of me, and I would be pissed and I would say something and push my way to the front. But if you don't know that you're being profiled on the web, and, you know, 5 years ago, an African-American lawyer wrote, you know, she tries to pass on the web and she'll put in false information. You can't do that anymore because everything you've done, your purchase on Amazon is linked to your Southwest Airlines movement or what things you've searched for. If you searched for hand tremors, that's thought to be about you, that you have an illness. That information is given to insurers and employers, and you might have been looking it up for a friend or for a mystery book you're writing.
Well, and just picking up on that, when you talk about data aggregators who are, in a sense, finding out information and what sharing that information with insurance companies, with companies, with advertisers?
Sure. And so one company, Axiom, has 1,500 pieces of information on 96% of Americans. So they know things like your credit score or what medications you're on. And you could see how that would be relevant to other people. So some organizations like that sell it entirely to marketing companies, employers, and so forth. But there's another group, Spokeo, S-P-O-K-E-O, where sells it directly to the public. So if you put your name into Spokeo.com, you can see that often they have your unlisted phone number, your address, maybe a Google map to your house and so forth. And for a few bucks a month, you can get bigger services. So you can find out what a person has posted elsewhere on the web, what social networks they're on, what photos or videos they've put up on YouTube and so forth, and what their financial status is. A million people a day are searching that and making decisions about everything, about whether to employ you or to give you a loan. I had no idea that existed either. And a lot of times it has false information. One guy even sued it and said, listen, credit reporting companies have to tell you they're collecting information and have to let you correct it. You've got all this wrong information about me. And the judge pretty much said, hey, that's too bad.
Mm. I do want to pick up on that, but I've been doing the show long enough that we predate the World Wide Web, as we called it, a number of years ago. And I do remember having a guest saying, think of an email as a postcard. I mean, whatever you email, imagine that other people are going to read it the way if you send out a postcard, it will be read by, or potentially read. Are those still operative words?
A New York judge has actually used that word and said an email is a postcard. It's based on some silly thinking about what the impact of the technology should be. That judge said, listen, you know, your emails go over a bunch of different routes through the web, and a hacker could sort of see it at any point. And so you should think of it as open. But we use the web for everything now. I contact my doctor on the web. I put my Social Security number in to get a fishing license in Florida, or my credit card number. And there's no way I would put that on a postcard. So it really isn't in sync with how people view it and how we need to use the web. And it's sort of like saying, because someone can hack in, we have no right to control it. Well, I have a house with windows, and we don't say, I can't take any action against a peeping Tom if someone presses their nose against my bedroom window. Even though it can be breached, that shouldn't set the rules for privacy.
But are you saying that the judges, broadly speaking, just haven't kept up with this technology, or that the laws are just antiquated to deal with some of these privacy and speech issues?
I think the judges haven't caught up, and that really we could be protecting privacy more under existing laws. But since that's not happening, I'm suggesting we sort of reintroduce these concepts of right to privacy and freedom of expression in some other ways.
In fact, you say democracy, and this, you know, this shouldn't be news to anybody, but democracy is about free speech. I mean, that is the kind of cornerstone of what democracy is.
Absolutely. And so if I post that real problems in a school where I'm teaching, for example, I shouldn't be fired as a result. Or if I criticize the local budgeting process. And yet that's happening. Straight-A students have been expelled from school for criticizing a teacher on their MySpace page. We're beginning to see, you know, a sort of tsunami of cases actually coming out of Pennsylvania on it. And ultimately, the federal appellate judges have upheld rights, free speech rights of public school students, but been less protective of employees.
Well, let's take a very short break. We'll get back to our conversation. I do want to open the lines as well. That phone number, 1-888-477-9499. Lori Andrews is our guest. She's the author of a scary-looking book I'm holding in my hands here. I Know Who You Are, and I Saw What You Did, Social Networks, and, as she says, The Death of Privacy. And we're going to take a very short break, get back to our conversation. We'll be talking about Facebook Nation and also a constitution that she has laid out to protect some of these speech and privacy issues online. Give us a call, 1-888-477-9499, 1-888-477-WHYY. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Fox Chase Cancer Center supports WHYY and recognizes Cervical Cancer Awareness Month. Approximately 12,000 new cases of invasive cervical cancer will be diagnosed this year in the U.S., Because early cervical cancers or precancers often have no signs or symptoms, the Pap test is the gold standard for screening. Catching this cancer early often leads to better outcomes. More at foxchase.org. Fox Chase Cancer Center. Hearts plus minds.
Hello, I'm Christine Dempsey.
And I'm Ed Cunningham.
Believe it or not, when Al Gore invented the internet, it was with YStream in mind.
YStream is a thank you gift that gives you online access to radio programs without pledge breaks.
And it'll be available to you during WHYY's upcoming member drive.
For all the details, including special discounts for current members, visit whyy.org/YStream.
We hope you'll look forward to not hearing us during the member drive.
And thanks for your support.
That witty banter between black friends and white friends has been a staple of sitcoms and buddy movies for years, but real conversations across the racial divide aren't always much fun.
You can say the N-word, but I can't? How is that okay?
We'll hear from a comedian behind a hit viral video about stuff white girls say to black girls. That's next time on Tell Me More.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen. Our guest, Laurie Andrews, says that many people are just much too trusting, believing that their online posts are private, when in fact data aggregators are collecting information with or without your permission. Any questions or comments that you might have about that? We're interested in whether you are worried about that or have some concerns about that. She's the author of a new book called I Know Who You Are and I Saw What You Did. She's director of the Institute for Science, Law, and Technology at the Illinois Institute of Technology. And again, just a couple open lines at 1-888-477-9499. You say if Facebook were a nation with its 750 million
Members,
it would be the third largest nation in the world.
It's behind China and India in size, so bigger than the United States, you know, bigger than Australia, you know. And I think that we haven't asked the question, you know, sort of what's its government. It's interesting to think of it as a nation, but it does have its own currency now. It has relations with other governments. When you think of, you know, China wants to shut it down, it has to negotiate and so forth. And what's been fascinating to me is that it makes the private public, so employers can get access, but it also makes the functions that a government usually does, public functions private. Cops and the IRS actually search your social network pages, and so the IRS will look at whether you're posted with a car that seems to be behind your means and check into how you could be, you know, earning that much. Are you hiding your assets? We're getting things called virtual deputies in Texas. They started this program where anybody on their computer can patrol the border. So you can, there are cameras all along the border to Mexico. You can go on it and look and report illegal border crossings. So you've got individuals who aren't bound by the rules of the U.S. Constitution turning into cops, and people are going on it, like a young mother in New York, someone in a pub in Australia. One woman also looks for bald eagles, and so she says, I search for eagles and illegals. But there's a lot of racism involved, and you don't know where it's going to turn, and maybe someone will take the law in their own hands. And so we need oversight of this country. I think people came to it the same way people come to most new countries, for a sense of freedom, but they also need to have some rights.
It must be said that there are many benefits of social networking sites as well. And I'm thinking what, you know, what has been going on in the Middle East and North Africa, for instance, the ability to connect over important social issues, the ability to stay connected to friends, which I do through Facebook, through Twitter, that kind of thing.
Absolutely. I think that the founding fathers would have been very impressed that you could seed a revolution by Twitter and Facebook and things on YouTube. I think the Egyptian analysis is really, really, really important. But we also have to note that American companies sold technologies to Egypt before the revolution that allowed them to track anonymous posters, and they put a lot of journalists in prison for just dissident thoughts. It's a technology where you leave a trail. And so we've got to take that into consideration if we want to value things like anonymity and political analysis.
Let me read from the very beginning of the social network constitution that you wrote. We, the people of Facebook Nation, in order to form a more perfect internet, to protect our fundamental rights and freedoms, to explore our identities, dreams, and relationships, to safeguard the sanctity of our digital selves, to ensure equal access to technology, to lessen discrimination and disparities, and to promote democratic principles and the general welfare, declare these truths to be self-evident. I won't read them all.
Yeah.
The right to connect, the right to free speech and freedom of expression, the right to privacy of place and information. Do we have a legal system that can protect these rights?
Well, one of our problems is that our U.S. Constitution, and it's the 225th anniversary of it this year, and it's been great and resilient, but it generally only applies to government action. And here you've got, you know, the Facebook Nation, which is doing things you would never allow a government to do. It's collecting information on 750 million people, the most private information. As a government, you couldn't do that without tons of lawyers and maybe even guns. And so we've got to be concerned. Other countries actually apply their constitutional principles to companies as well. And we have had instances like the privacy rights that are in the U.S. Constitution are also part of state laws to be used against companies as well as government agencies. So we do need some move to take those principles and embody them in the corporate world as well as in the governmental world.
Well, let me quote from your constitution here. The right to privacy in one's social networking profiles, accounts, related activities, and data derived therefrom shall not be abridged. The right to privacy includes the right of to security of information and security of place, regardless of active security settings or an individual's efforts to guard his or her digital self. Social networks are private places. So you're saying, you know, my Facebook page, my social network accounts, those belong to me.
Yes, and I think it's in keeping with the fact that we really protect heavily privacy of place. You know, we can't break into someone's home to get information. And you can think of that as your digital home in a way. Also, we protect really private information, like our medical information. Mm-hmm. You might be posting on your social network page, you got a doctor appointment tomorrow. You might be saying, I like the Cystic Fibrosis Association or the Diabetes Association. The Philadelphia Bar Association, believe it or not, had one of the best analyses in an ethics opinion. A lawyer wanted to be able to have one of his employees mm-hmm. friend a witness to mm-hmm. get information against her. And the witness had an open Facebook page, would friend anyone. And he said, I want to be able to adjust her, make an analysis of her credibility by fake friending her. And the court said, and the Philadelphia Bar Association said, even though she's open to everybody, you're not allowed to do that because her Facebook page is her digital mm-hmm. home. And it would be like putting a webcam in her house to look at what she's doing. And I like that analysis of your Facebook page as being like your home and nobody's allowed to come in. Right now with data aggregators, what happens is they'll put cookies on your computer and you've got to find out who put that cookie there, which you might not even realize is there, go on their corporate webpage and ask to opt out. Now, to me, that's like going home, finding 20 strangers in your house and have to individually ask them to go. Why not have it be like the real world where they don't get to come in my house unless I invite them first?
Well, I'm thinking of impersonating, sort of fake friending somebody. I mean, could the court see that as fraud? I don't know if impersonation is against the law or not.
It's usually not, but California has a new statute about e-personation because we've had a number of cases not only of identity theft, but where the parents of a teenage rival will actually push their daughter's rival to suicide by pretending to be a 16-year-old boy and befriending the young girl and then telling her she's worthless, she should kill herself, and so forth. So there are concerns. Now, e-personation is different than anonymity, and I think mm-hmm. I'm a really strong protector of the right to post anonymously, you know, particularly complaints about your employer, your politicians, and so forth. So I was really troubled when the marketing director of Facebook last year called for an end to anonymity, saying anonymity in the internet has to go away, because that's really part of our political process.
And that's Laurie Andrews, our guest today on Radio Times. We're talking about the internet, privacy, free speech. She says perhaps it's time for a constitution to protect some of those rights on social networks. And she's the author of a new book called I Know Who You Are and I Saw What You Did. Just a couple open lines at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. What do you do to protect yourself online? Let's see what Dan from Florida has to say. And Dan, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yes, good morning.
Good morning.
My question is that most of the browsers nowadays, you've got a secure option. You can open up a new window, and it does not leave any trails, allegedly. And I'm wondering how does that affect your vulnerability, and also if it's a good idea to just pretty much browse like that all the time.
Thanks for calling in, Dan.
Yeah,
go
I think
ahead.
You're right. Google Chrome has, you can search in incognito by doing, I think, Control-Shift-N. I mean, that is a good way to prevent your searches from being connected to other things you do on your web, like your credit card number or your notes to your doctor. But it doesn't protect you against things like deep packet inspection, the deal that marketing companies make with your internet service provider, which can collect everything and have some powers to de-encrypt. But a very good idea, and there are even if you're doing something especially sensitive. Mm. There are even services, free services, that will encrypt for you. The Electronic Frontier Foundation has information about that on their website. They're a nonprofit to protect privacy on the web. They talk about Tor, one of the encryption. So there are things you can do. I think it's a good idea to do it, and but there are some ways to get around it.
Well, and how would data aggregators, whom you have talked about, how would they function under your constitution? What rights would they have?
Oh, my goodness. I would say the rights are really to the consumer and not the data aggregators. And so if I want to get ads from Urban Outfitters or something or get a deal, I can affirmatively say yes, as opposed to having 300 companies just plop something on my computer to track me and then sell that to potential employers. So I would have an opt-in model rather than an opt-out model. And that's how we view privacy all over our lives off the web.
But it's so interesting that it's the reverse on the web. Is that just because it's new?
I think it's because it's new. And so I look at it like other areas I've worked in. I previously have written about genetic privacy, and I chaired the Federal Advisory Commission of the Human Genome Project. And initially, anybody would have access to your genetic information. And employers could choose not to hire a healthy person because their genetic makeup suggested that they might be at higher than average risk for a later cancer. And so people made a lot of bad uses of this, insurers, employers, dating services. And eventually, we got a federal law passed, the Genetic Information Non-Discrimination Act, to prevent against that. So it's part of it, we're early in the technologies. But part of it is that, you know, people assume this is just fair game for the public. And I've been distressed that in every other area, when I've followed court cases, things like genetic technologies, medical technologies, forensic technologies, courts have actually expanded our rights to privacy. Hmm. And here the judges have thrown up their hands and said, you lose your rights on affirmative keystroke. You know, and so think about it. Forensic technology came along where a cop on the street could point a heat detection device at your house to see if there tend to be more lights on, suggesting you might be growing marijuana. The Supreme Court says, no, you know, we've got to protect privacy in the home, even if you don't actually enter the home to get the information. And yet, with social networks, we see the opposite happening.
They are entering. They're in our home,
they're
actually.
They're in their home.
Let me get, looks like Jamie from Drexel Hill to join our conversation. And Jamie, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I am a medical professional, and I just moved here to the greater Philadelphia area. And my question is this, and by the way, this is a fabulous program.
Thank you.
How in the world do I manage to be an active working person and still utilize the net in not just my personal life, but in my professional life? For example, I tried to undo some cookies once, and it took hours and hours and hours and hours. I joined up with LinkedIn to be connected with peers and for job hunting. Do you have any practical suggestions?
Oh, that's a great
sure.
question.
Well, I
go
think
ahead,
the searching in private mode is important. But you're right. They've made it almost impossible. If you say, ask me before you put a cookie on, some websites won't even load. Hmm. And you can go on. It's good to clear cookies from time to time and so forth and opt out and that. But we really need some larger protections. Hmm. We've got some people in Congress concerned about this, Patrick Leahy, Senator Al Franken, and so forth, because you're in a vulnerable position. I'm glad you brought up the medical information, Ann,
sure.
because here's information we protect so heavily, but if you look at HIPAA and the privacy regulations, they only protect that information in certain institutions' hands, health providers or healthcare institutions. If you post on the web, you're joining a group, you know, that will help you manage your diabetes, that information could be used against you. There was a great social network, patients like me, people would go on it and say, you know, I'm depressed, I'm suicidal, I have Alzheimer's, I have this disease. And other patients would give advice and tell what drugs worked or what other therapies worked. Well, then Nielsen Company, a big data aggregator, posed as a patient, sent bots on the website to collect personal information from everybody. And when the users of patients like me found out, they started pulling their post, as you can imagine. And so here we had a great social network that helped people who had rare conditions, who were, you know, maybe were in some distant area in Montana or someplace where they didn't know others with the same disease, a great benefit. And, you know, the fact that we had laws that weren't protective was a real tragedy.
Well, I'm wondering, even Jamie's question, and I think she speaks for a lot of people, which is that, you know, we're online, we're using the internet, we have private lives, we have professional lives, and I'm even curious for yourself, do you have a Facebook page? Do you tweet? What do you do with emails? I mean, how do you live in our on the web?
Yeah, it's very funny because I was writing this book and I told all my friends, you know, I'm really not going to come out up for air until a particular date. You know, and on that date, I went to a picnic with some friends and dinner with other friends. By the next day, two unattractive pictures of me putting food in my mouth had been posted on
friends,
Facebook,
right?
You know, like the very thing I was writing about. It's impossible to be doing anything in the media world and the publishing industry without having a Facebook page. You're almost required. I had to get on Twitter as part of this, you know, book launch and so forth. But I've got to tell you, I have had, when I went around the country doing video interviews with lawyers and individuals who'd been harmed by social network postings, one woman law professor actually refused to go on camera. She said she's seen too many things where women have been attacked, and Kathy Sierra, who was a blogger who had a very highly rated blog site, it seems like the men who were jealous of her in that world started using her picture, and they would post it with a noose around her neck or red lace panties stuffed in her mouth. And so there's this aggressive misuse also, cyber harassment, particularly of women in the tech world.
But, I mean, all that is true, and there's also...
I'm careful with what, you know, I do not post. I'm careful with what I post, but you have to be careful on so many levels.
Sure.
You take a picture with an iPhone, it has a geotag on it. So if a woman's showing off her new engagement ring, there could be someone could break in. I mean, in New Hampshire, 50 robberies were committed when a group of thieves just searched social network pages for the word vacation. And they
and
went
found out who was not home.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, let's take another short break. We'll get back to our conversation and to our callers as well. We have one or two open lines at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. We are talking with privacy expert Lori Andrews, author of a new book called I Know Who You Are. And I Saw What You Did, Social Networks and the Death of Privacy. That's the subtitle of the book. She's a law professor, also director of the Institute for Science, Law, and Technology at the Illinois Institute of Technology. And we're going to carry on our conversation after this very short break. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Westown School supports WHYY. Since 1799, Westown has invited students pre-K through grade 12 to pursue a life-size education, one that helps to prepare each student for what comes next, not only for college and career, but for a whole life. You can learn more by attending Westown's open house on Saturday, January 14th at 10 a.m. Details at westown.edu. Westown School, a life-size education.
I do so long to go through the crowded streets of your mighty London.
Actor Gary Oldman is so good at what he does, you might not recognize him from role to role. From his campy portrayal of Dracula, to Sirius Black in Harry Potter, and now George Smiley in Tinker, Tailor, Soldier, Spy. Gary Oldman on the next Fresh Air.
This afternoon at 3, and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. What are Ford, Chrysler, GM, Chinese automakers up to at the Detroit Auto Show? Also, music producer Betty Wright, she coached Gloria Estevan, taught J-Lo to sing, Beyonce samples her. Now Betty Wright is getting back behind the mic with a new album. That's Public Radio's Daily Digest of News and Culture, here and now.
today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowane. Do we need a social network constitution? Our guest, Lori Andrews, thinks we do. In fact, she has written one, and it's at the very end of her new book, I Know Who You Are, and I Saw What You Did. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Lori, we've been talking about these data aggregators who are, you know, in a sense, behind our backs or could be behind our backs, getting information about us. But even before we went on the air, you and I were talking about, and I take the train to work, so I hear people talking to friends online on their phones. I see what people are doing on their laptops as well. It's not as if these are data aggregators; these are individuals that might be spreading information that essentially we're not entitled to.
I think that people really feel like they're the center of their own movie and they have control over it. In fact, there are now the legal associations have had to come to terms with whether it's ethical if you look at the laptop of the guy next to you on a plane and find out something about his business that could help your client. That's thought to be unethical, but I also think it's pretty stupid of someone to be showing that information. And in fact, just at breakfast at the Omni Hotel here in Philadelphia, I could overhear this intense business conversation next to me. And at the end, I said, well, I'm actually a customer of this esoteric business they were discussing. They're like, oh, please don't, you know, use any of this information against us. But it's sort of odd to talk about this in a private place. And I think this being the center of your own movie is such a strong psychological thing. And I saw it in the case where a 54-year-old judge in a Georgia court actually friended on Facebook the female defendant in his courtroom and told her how to plead. You know, you sort of think that people won't notice that you're doing these sorts of things.
But one could also imagine an analog version of that. I mean, maybe the judge wouldn't necessarily see that that person in his courtroom, but...
I think that it underscores what's probably been going on. So in trials, you're not supposed to talk about it, what's going on with other people. And probably people for years talk to their spouse about the trial. But now jurors are tweeting. In one case, the juror put up all the facts of the case on her Facebook page. She said, I can't decide, so I'm going to take a vote. Well, you're only supposed to be able to judge based on evidence in a courtroom. But with a smartphone, people are looking up, Googling the scene of the crime, looking at witnesses' Facebook pages to determine whether they're credible or not. We've had to throw out a bunch of trials. States have had to retry people. And I think that that's a good example, because I probably in the analog days would not have gone to the library and looked up some medical concept about a case. But if I can do it, you know, so it's both showing us the bad things that happened before, but also making them worse in a way.
But I could also imagine that person saying, well, you know, I have free speech rights. I can share this information with my friends.
I think that people need to realize that even the U.S. Constitution is a balance all the time of the right to say fair press and fair trial. And so we're often negotiating between free speech and privacy rights. You know, if I say something defamatory in a newspaper about somebody else, that's not really my free speech right, you know, if I've disclosed harmful and untrue information. So it's a negotiation, but it's gone all to one side right now.
Let me get Katie from Westchester to join our conversation. Hi, Katie. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Good morning, ladies.
Good morning.
Thank you for having me on the show.
You're very welcome.
My quick question was, as a full-time student with filling in loans and all that stuff, data aggregators, how can students, especially students, protect themselves when their Social Security number and all of their information to get loans from not only the government but private loan places be protected with the data aggregators?
It's a very good question, Katie. Go ahead, Lori.
I think in... as much as you can, send social security numbers through faxes, fill out the forms, fax it, mail it, see if you have some other option. Because if it goes in email, it's just too easy to get and use against you. But an astonishing study last year by Carnegie Mellon researchers found that using facial recognition software and linking it to things on the web, they could guess the five digits of people's social security numbers. They also could use facial recognition software and take pictures from dating sites that were put up with pseudonyms and matched 1 in 10 of them to the actual social network page of the person. So I'd be really cautious, especially about social security numbers in terms of sending them, around in different ways rather than email, call the person up, have them fill it in on their end, send it over fax, make it a little harder.
Well, and I wonder whether students, and she's talking about a student loan here, but whether students are in any ways more vulnerable than others to some of this data aggregating?
Well, you know who's the most vulnerable? Female doctors. And so their identities are often taken, surprisingly. This happened to, in fact, a psychiatrist friend of mine. And actually, her credit card company said, we think you should just change your name. Become a different person. But, she'd published all these things under her name. That's not a very good system. But some tech law people are actually telling college students, oh, change your name when you get out of college.
And then why would female doctors be more vulnerable?
I think they're high earners. And so probably doctors in general, but maybe they're hugely busy. A lot of them are managing, homes and families and their practice, and so might be a little less likely to have the time to go through every credit card statement before they see the problem. But Jeffrey Deaver, the novelist, his identity was taken, and that made him write a novel about data aggregators.
Let me get Katie. Thanks for the call. Let's see what Cheryl from Downingtown has to say. Cheryl, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Oh, thank you. You shocked me when you said that employers were asking for passwords to go into sites. I have a lot of unemployed people that I work with, and I was curious what advice you would give them of what they should do or should not do, because they have almost no way to avoid the web. I mean, they're going to have a resume out there. They're going to have a LinkedIn page. What would you suggest they do or not do?
Cheryl, thanks for the call. Go ahead, Laurie.
Well, I think that, being very careful if you're in the stage of looking for a job to being very careful about what photos in particular you post, since that can be used against you whether or not you're doing something legal. So I'd first of all be careful about that. Going to private mode is important, but it turns out there are companies that collect everything from people's public Facebook pages, keep it for 7 years, and sell it to employers. So if you right now make your Facebook page private, they may have had the things that you've posted in previous years and made that available. But I'd just be careful of the image you project. I, in fact, got first interested in this when the college-age daughter of a friend of mine said that she was applying to a college and wanted to get a good job. And she friended me on Facebook, and every time I'd go on, there'd be a note she was playing Mafia Wars. Well, it ultimately turned out it was her boyfriend, but I said, you've got to clean up your Facebook profile if you want to be hired and get into a good college. And she didn't believe people could have access. And so I started collecting all the cases, all the data, all the surveys, and it eventually turned into this book.
But just picking up on what Cheryl said, so if my employer or anyone else's employer says, I want your personal email address, are they entitled to have that?
I would call the ACLU. That should be on speed dial if you're doing that, because the ACLU was able to beat back some of this in particular states by making the company promise it would be voluntary, but that's still coercive. Mm-hmm. I think we need something more protective.
Let me get, looks like Joel from Westchester to join our conversation. And Joel, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you for my call.
You're very welcome.
I wanted to comment. I'm a criminal defense attorney, and I've had numerous cases play out based on issues that have come up through social networking and the discovery process, meaning the district attorney accesses their Facebook page sometimes without even a subpoena, simply because they can log on and the privacy settings aren't correct, take a look at everything my client may have put up there, and often there's evidence that tends to incriminate my client because of their lack of discretion. And it's definitely played out to where I've lost cases simply because of that.
Wow.
Yeah,
go ahead, Laurie.
I certainly have seen that, but I've also seen just enormous number of misuses. So a young kid wearing quote-unquote gang colors will have their penalty enhanced or will be charged as a gang member. And so I looked up the Los Angeles Police Department's gang colors list, and it's things such as plaid or all black. So if you think of any hipster or art opening. Now, I'll tell you, Joel, one thing that's happening is that defendants are now subpoenaing the cops' MySpace page. And there was an interesting case where someone who had been charged with having a gun in violation of probation actually got the MySpace page of the cop where he had set his emoticon on MySpace to devious. And the defendant used that to convince the jury that the gun had actually been planted on him. And so some defense attorneys are fighting back in that way. And now some police departments say you can't even disclose that you're a cop on Facebook or MySpace. So it's very, very interesting. But you're right. This anything has come back to haunt people.
Joel, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Let me quote something that was in the paper today about your book, and it's quoting from David Post. He's a professor at Temple University, in fact, was a guest on Radio Times, wrote a book called In Search of Jefferson's Moose. This takes us back to the Founding Fathers, but he says Jefferson would have loved Facebook. He was a lover of technology and gadgets, a free speech guy, and so the web's access to the latest information, the latest science, he would have been crazy over the net as a storage and retrieval system, especially at the global ability to communicate. The idea that while this does raise some interesting constitutional questions, perhaps some of the founders would have loved social networks.
Oh my God, you got to imagine that the founders actually were techies. They included in the Constitution a patent clause to try to encourage innovation. So I think they would love that. But they also were in favor of anonymity, were in favor of privacy. And so the fact that they created a Fourth Amendment where police can't search the drawers in your bureau to get your papers, well, the equivalent of this is going online in violation of the Fourth Amendment, and my papers are now in the cloud. So we've got to protect them there, not just in my drawer.
You mentioned the fact that you were part of, as a lawyer, had an interest in reproductive genetic technologies, the Human Genome Project. Can we take then, some of what has been instituted from the Human Genome Project and apply it to the web?
You know, I think we can, because that was very private information about people, the very sequence, their genetic identity. And here we're talking about the types of things that people routinely post on social networks, which give also a whole view of the person. And these data aggregators may think they've got a free pass for the rest of their lives, but it might turn out to be exactly like genetic privacy, where after a few years, courts and legislatures get it right and say, no, you've been unjustly enriched by being able to steal a bunch of people's information without giving thought to their privacy.
Let me see what Fred from Fairmount has to say. And Fred, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Oh, good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you very much.
You're very welcome.
I am a computer security professional, and I'm a big fan of Google Chrome, and I do appreciate the fact that they have added some privacy features to their browser, as has Firefox. The trouble is that they are mostly useful for blocking somebody with local access to your computer from knowing where you've been. So, for example, if you're trying to hide your browsing habits from your spouse. Once you log into a website like Facebook, you are right back in the eyes of whoever can track you through Facebook. In addition, just blocking cookies isn't enough. There are scripts, even Flash, which you use to play videos on YouTube, can be used to do some identification, tracking, and geolocation. So, aside from almost crippling your browser so much that many modern websites won't run, you're really kind of in a bind if you're talking about data aggregators. I heard some mention of Tor earlier. That's probably the best way to go if you're really concerned about your privacy.
Well, Fred, hold on, because let me give Laurie Andrews a chance to respond.
Yeah. You're absolutely right. I was... it was a shock to Facebook when they learned that Mafia Wars, a game, was transmitting personal information, and in fact, to a company called Rapleaf, which sold it to Republican candidates. And so they could find out at the individual level who had things on their Facebook page about Bible studies and things like that, and target them with emails. So you see, it's like corrupting even the political process. Fred, do you have any magic charm for us? I think you've talked about the encryption program Tor, but
anything
you know,
else
what
you
should we
add?
Do? What should we do,
Go
Fred?
Ahead. Go ahead, Fred. Well, you have about 30 seconds. Go ahead.
No question that if, you know, the only real option is not to opt in. Once you've opted in, you're in. If you use Tor and it's a very easy program to install, the Electronic Frontier Foundation is a great place to go to get a good primer on it. You can maintain your anonymity, but it's only as long as you don't personally identify yourself.
Mm. Great. Yeah, well, this may be why we need external laws to assure our right to privacy to stop this collection of data about us. It certainly has upended privacy. It's not like anything the founders mentioned or we, you know, anticipate will happen to us. And so I think we need definite change.
Fred, thanks for the call. And we're almost out of time here, Laurie. But would you say we're in this sort of wake up phase where we're using all this stuff and beginning to see that it has some kind of repercussion?
We're beginning to see, you know, the bad things happen. The woman lose custody of her child because of a posts of in provocative dress or where she says something sexy, things that shouldn't occur. And that, and so what's going to happen is we'll lose all the benefits of social networks if people just start pulling out, or they start branding themselves since birth by only, you know, by hiring someone to plant smart things on their Facebook page.
So I mean, we want this stuff, but we just have to figure out how to do a better job.
It's a new frontier, and we need some policing at the borders.
Well, Laurie Andrews, thank you for joining us today on Radio Times. And her book is called I Know Who You Are and I Saw What You Did, and it's subtitled Social Networks and the Death of Privacy. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times. And yes, we have Facebook. Yes, we have Twitter. You can send us an email. We will not, at least knowingly, send it to anybody else. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, and the show is produced by Susan Greenbaum, Patty Leswing, Dennis Devine, and Debbie Builder. I'm Marty Moscow, and thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.